Welcome back to Head Games with Seth Joyner, and we're very lucky to be joined by Howie Long. Howie, I think you blocked one of my kicks back in the day, didn't you?
I can't remember last week.
You jerk?
You want me to remember that?
No, I think you blocked one against us on a Monday night or Thursday night game, and I've never fully recovered from that. You and Ted Hendricks were the only guys that blocked kicks in games.
Ted,
I just wanted to bring that up, buddy.
Well, Ted usually was the guy, because Ted was so big. People don't realize how big Ted was. Ted was one of those unique players who was, you know, and there are not many of them. I'd say Lawrence Taylor and maybe a Kellen Winslow, guys like that, who were ahead of their time. Ted was ahead of his time, and I don't know how many kicks he blocked, but it was probably as many as anyone in NFL history. And Matt Millen and I were usually just the guys that tried to run someone over and let Ted jump. So if I blocked one, it was by accident.
Yeah, whatever. Hey, listen, Howie, one of my favorite memories of Ted Hendricks is in the 82 Pro Bowl. It's a very close game, and I'm looking at Ted, and he's about 10 yards down the sidelines. I walk over to him, and he's in his own world. I said, what are you doing? He said, I got to make a play. He went in the very next play and intercepted the ball. We drove down, and I was lucky enough to kick a short field goal to win the game because I was threatened with my life if I didn't make it. But my memory of Ted is that specific moment in time when he just knew he had to do something and got it done. So, go ahead.
Ted was, I remember coming in there as a rookie from Villanova, and, you know, walking into that Raider locker room was, you know, going from the dorm at Villanova to the Oakland Raider locker room was a lot like going from, you know, a monastery to a halfway house. It was different, and we had some great players at that time, and I had the good fortune of being a part of, you know, the next generation, but overlapping with the Gene Upshaws and the Art Shells and the Ted Hendricks and Cliff Branch and Van Egan and Plunkett and Casper and, you know, players like that. And Ted was the smartest player I have ever played with. He could sit in a film room on Monday morning, you know, still kind of showing the effects of the celebration from the night before, and we'd throw on the film of the upcoming opponent, and Ted could call off the plays before they were even run. He was so knowledgeable and so smart, and for me to have had the opportunity to play with him for, you know, 4 or 5 years in the beginning of my career had a profound effect. And you talk about the pressure you run at that Pro Bowl. Remember, at that time, you know, if you were married and you had kids, or, you know, you brought a guest, that trip to Hawaii ended up costing you quite a bit, because a glass of orange juice was about $35 out of your honor bar at the hotel, and the loser of the game, I think, at that point got $5,000, and the winner got $7,000, and that was big money
right
back in those days, remember?
Oh, yeah, Jack Lambert said, buddy, you better make this kick or I'll kill you. He was the left wing on
and
the
he
team,
meant
and there's
it
a photo of him, and he meant it.
Oh, yeah, Jack Lambert was exactly the way I thought Jack Lambert would be, and I was a big Pittsburgh Steeler guy in college, and he walked in that huddle with no teeth, just flicked his cigarette out of his hand and told us the way it was going to be. different generation, Nick.
Howie, times have changed, but it's always about the players that can get it done when it matters most. And as you look at the matchups this weekend, all four games to me last week were great. And now you have the situation where certain teams find a way to get it done. We saw it, and we talk about it all the time with the Patriots. Of these four teams in this new situation, who are the teams that strike you as most able and most likely to win on Sunday?
Golly, you look at the matchup we have in Chicago, and, you know, a Bears team, particularly on defense, that started the year off the first six or seven games, and we were talking about them in historical perspective, you know, defensively. And Rex Grossman was a guy who was performing extremely well, and they seemed to be the team to beat by far. And Indianapolis started off the season as hot as could be and then started to struggle defensively. And New England was New England. You know, they weren't spectacular, but they were New England, and they were in front of their division, and they seemed to be trying to find their stride in terms of the wide receiver position. They had a number of injuries on defense, and the New Orleans Saints are a magical team. 29 new players, new quarterback. Deuce McAllister is a guy who blew his ACL out last season, rushed back and has played extremely well. Reggie Bush has been a real shot in the arm for both New Orleans, the Gulf Coast region, and the NFL. And Sean Payton has done a remarkable job, and Mickey Loomis has done a remarkable job in bringing players in there, and all new linebackers and new defensive system, new offensive system, a team that was essentially a nomad team last year, traveling from place to place and practicing in temporary facilities, being pushed out of their facilities in San Antonio. For them to have not only won their division, but they seem to be peaking at the right time. You know, and the Indianapolis-New England matchup, to me, when Peyton Manning goes to bed at night, he doesn't check his closet for the boogeyman. He checks his closet for Tom Brady. It is, if they are to go, and I think this is probably the best opportunity they have, and I think that window is closing, that window of opportunity, and you know how that is. You've been on teams that have gone through cycles where, you know, the talent cycle is coming to a conclusion, and if you're going to get it done, you're going to get it done now. And I think this is the best opportunity for them, and how poetic would it be for them to accomplish that at home, beating a team that has two times up in New England spoiled their opportunity and their chance to get to the Super Bowl. And then you have the possibility of a Lovie Smith versus Tony Dungy Super Bowl. Would be the first time in the history of the NFL you'd have two African-American coaches coaching the two Super Bowl teams. And I think you think back to the pre-Doug Williams Super Bowl and you say, you know, it was pointed out that Doug Williams is an African-American quarterback, and I think Doug Williams winning that Super Bowl in many ways made that a non-issue. And I don't think we think of quarterbacks in those terms. He's just a quarterback. And I think an African-American coach winning a Super Bowl would in many ways make that a non-issue and be another step towards, that not being a topic of conversation on a yearly basis.
Seth Joyner, that's a very interesting subject, and we've talked about it before. Clearly, several of the very top head coaches in the NFL now are black coaches. Do you think that a Super Bowl victory is required, as Howie said, to get to that next level of respect?
Not respect. Just not a topic of conversation where it's not, you know, when I look at a quarterback, I look at a quarterback. I don't care if he's African-American, white, or whatever. I think we're beyond that. I think we're close to that with head coaches. That was my point.
I just think to legitimize the fact that, you know, that African-Americans can assume that role and be successful in that role, that victory is needed. Until Doug Williams won the Super Bowl and legitimized that thought, I don't think, you know, there were some black quarterbacks, but I don't think anybody really deep down inside, you know, the powers that be in football really believe that a black quarterback could take a team to the Super Bowl and actually win a Super Bowl. Well, I think that is probably the same situation as far as head coach is concerned, and anytime you get in a situation where one of these, you know, African-American coaches has an opportunity to win, the only thing it does is legitimizes the fact, you know, and legitimizes the idea that, you know what, they can get the job done. They're just as qualified as anyone else to hold that position and take that team to the pinnacle of the NFL season, so to speak.
Yeah, you know, I think it's really, you know, and Seth makes the point, you know, Doug Williams championing that team of the Washington Redskins, it kind of no longer became an issue, and whatever anyone's perception was or opinion was, it just didn't factor in anymore. And you know, I think now when we talk about quarterbacks in the NFL, we talk about how they play, what their production is. We don't talk about them, at least I don't view that as being a topic of discussion. I've certainly never looked at Tony Dungy and said he needs to be validated by winning a Super Bowl. I think what it does is it's it's historical, and I think it allows, I think, an entire NFL community to turn the page and for the better. It'll be great.
Well, let's talk some specifics here. The Indy defense, I think, is every bit as important, if not more, than the state of mind of Peyton Manning and the pressure that he feels in this game. Bob Sanders, everybody's talking about what a difference he makes to the mentality of that defense, specifically against the run. Howie, what do you think is the biggest change in the last couple games, besides Bob Sanders?
Well, you know, I don't know if Seth will agree with me, but I think Bob Sanders coming back is important. I think there are a number of players in the NFL, a Ray Lewis, a Brian Dawkins, players like that, who will the people around them to elevate their level of play and their commitment. And I don't want to downplay his contributions or him coming back, but I think Seth will agree with me. I think the biggest problem the Indianapolis Colts had was, one, they were rushing the quarterback on every single play, and two, they didn't have the mindset of being interested in stopping the run. You know, if we happen to fall into the run on the way to the quarterback, you know, fine. But to me, if you're going to win a championship or if you're going to be contending for a championship, you need to be able to do two things: stop the run and run the football, particularly at the end of the ball game. And I think that was something they did last week in Baltimore to a great extent. And I don't want to put too much into beating Kansas City at home, a one-dimensional Kansas City, albeit with a Larry Johnson who I consider to be just a horse. I mean, he is a great, great player. And then beating a Baltimore team on the road and dominating them to a great extent in terms of their run game and their offense, but it's an average Baltimore offense. I think this week will be more of a test for them because they face a team that has balance with Maroney and Dillon and Tom Brady, and they're gifted at the tight end position, and they have wide receivers that are growing into the position but certainly capable. So I think this week will be more of a kind of an indication of where the Colts are on defense.
We've got a quick call from Giovanni of St. Louis. You just got a few seconds here in this segment. Giovanni, what's your question?
Heck, how you doing?
Doing fine.
Hey, of course, I'm a longtime Chiefs fan, and I think, Carl Peterson's done. I mean, I'd get rid of him. That five-year plan's been turned into a 20-year plan or whatever it was now, and I'm also predicting the Patriots over the Colts.
And, all right, buddy. Well, thanks for... We got to go to a break here, but we'll talk in a brief moment when we come back with Howie Long. Final thoughts about Carl Peterson, about the top general managers and their role in the NFL, with Howie Long and Seth Joyner on Head Games on Sports Byline and Sirius Channel 122. Stay with us.